The Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, December 23rd, 2025.
And welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to cut through all the noise, taking these complex documents, the corporate filings, those high-stakes policy reports, and some really surprising social data, and translate it all into knowledge you can actually use. I'm your guide, ready to wade through the complexity and pull out those essential nuggets.
And I'm here to provide the context, the critical analysis. We're not just going to read headlines today. Yeah. We're going to dissect the underlying strategy, and we'll connect a boardroom battle in Hollywood all the way to a policy clash over offshore wind, and then analyze what that, well, interconnected chaos really means for you.
Yeah, and today we're focusing intensely on some major corporate power plays, the really volatile intersection of U.S. policy and global markets, and some, frankly, deeply worrying insights into health and the social safety net.
It is a massive stack of sources, so let's just unpack this immediately. We'll start with a true Goliath struggle in the media industry. I'm talking about the battle for Hollywood. We have this three-way fight happening around Warner Bros., Discovery Studios, Paramount, and Netflix. And the key leverage point right now, it isn't really the price. It's the absolute certainty of the financing.
And what's so fascinating here is that the financing mechanism itself has, you know, it's become a strategic weapon. We are seeing two fundamentally different ways of ensuring a deal actually closes. We're talking equity versus debt. And the public is getting a front row seat to the kind of colossal guarantees needed to make these bids credible.
Okay, so let's start with Paramount. They've amended their hostile all-cash tender offer for all of Warner Bros. Discovery.
Right.
The price is still a staggering $77.9 billion, which is $30 per share. But the crucial change was aimed directly at WBD's previous dismissal of their financial backing.
Yeah, their illusory financing, as they called it.
Exactly. So Larry Ellison, the Oracle billionaire, he has personally guaranteed $40.4 billion of equity financing for this deal. He even published records related to the family trust that backstops it.
And that is the key move. Warner Bros. Discovery's board had, as you said previously, called Paramount's financing illusory, which is a term that implies, you know, the money might not actually materialize when it's needed.
It's a big accusation.
It is. So this, and that's where Netflix's counter strategy on financing comes in. While Paramount focused on finding a massive equity guarantor, Netflix focused on debt security. Netflix secured up to $25 billion in bank financing for its deal.
So how did that break down?
Well, it includes a $5 billion senior unsecured revolving credit facility and then two senior unsecured delayed draw term loan facilities that total $20 billion. Now, to simplify all that financial jargon for you.
Please.
These are essentially highly assured lines of credit from major banks. We're talking Wells Fargo, BNP Paribas, and HSBC that make that $25 billion readily available the moment the deal closes. This structure, it essentially guarantees Netflix can provide the cash portion of its bid immediately, and it neutralizes any doubts about their ability to execute.
So we have two heavily financed, very complicated bids, and both are arguing they're superior. But this isn't just a business story, is it? This is where the political overtones make this whole M&A battle just explode.
Oh, absolutely. The Ellison factor introduces some very significant political weight. The Ellisons are well-known allies of President Trump, who, as we know, has publicly advocated for new ownership for CNN.
And CNN is, of course, a major and often controversial asset within that Warner Bros. Discovery portfolio.
Exactly. So David Ellison, who's Paramount's CEO, along with his father's backing, is subtly, or maybe not so subtly, arguing that his proposal offers a cleaner path to regulatory approval precisely because of those political relationships.
That's a key piece of strategic leverage right there. The Ellisons are leveraging their political capital to suggest they have a smooth path through Washington.
Precisely. They are implying their deal faces fewer regulatory hurdles because of their alignment. Netflix, on the other hand, is battling this narrative by arguing that its market share should be defined very broadly to include free services like YouTube to avoid antitrust issues.
They're trying to make themselves look smaller in the space.
They are. And they've even agreed to an unusually high $5.8 billion termination fee if the deal is blocked by regulators. That signals their serious commitment despite any of these potential political headwinds.
Okay, let's quickly review the immediate market reaction to all this activity because it really tells us what the shareholders are thinking. WBD shares, they rose 3.5% to $28.75. Paramount climbed 4.3% to 1361.
And Netflix?
Netflix, surprisingly, slipped 1.2% to 9323. And that WDD share price is critical, isn't it? It's still sitting below Paramount's $30 all-cash offer.
It is, which suggests that shareholders still harbor some doubts about the Paramount deal actually closing, or maybe they see more long-term strategic value in the Netflix Studios and streaming-only proposal, even if it's currently valued a bit lower.
So what's the long-term play here?
Well, the long-term implication, as it's being framed by Jerry Cardinale of Redbird Capital Partners, who's a Paramount stakeholder, is that a combined Paramount-WBD immediately creates a three-horse race in subscription streaming.
Competing with who?
Competing head-to-head with Netflix and Disney. This suggests that the stakeholders, at least, believe regulators will ultimately approve the merger. They see it as necessary to create balance in the industry, rather than consolidating power into a new monopoly. This M&A battle is truly defining the structure of American entertainment for the next decade.
And the financial battles are only part of the story. Once that ownership changes hands, the philosophical, the journalistic battles, they begin immediately. Mm. We're seeing that play out right now at CBS News, a network that is literally part of the merger target.
You really cannot discuss the CBS News upheaval without remembering that the editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss, was hired after Paramount bought her news and opinion site, The Free Press, for $150 million.
Right.
So the intent was always a fundamental editorial overhaul to promote a kind of journalism that seeks to understand rather than just demonize.
And the latest controversy surrounds Vice's decision to pull a 60 Minutes segment over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
This piece was highly anticipated. It was already promoted last week. Slated to run on Sunday.
Yeah.
And it concerned a maximum security prison in El Salvador, where the Trump administration had been sending hundreds of Venezuelan migrants.
And Vice defended the decision. She stated publicly that the story simply wasn't ready. Her core argument was that since the horrific treatment of Venezuelan migrants in this prison is already publicly known, running the story 2 months later requires every effort to get the principals on the record and on camera.
So she's saying the bar is higher now.
She's saying the bar is higher. Mm-hmm. She stressed the importance of a newsroom culture where contentious disagreements happen with respect. The editorial standard was raised, in her view, to meet the gravity of the subject.
But that decision drew some really sharp internal criticism. High-profile correspondent Sharon Alfonsi immediately weighed in, and she called the move a political decision, not a purely editorial one, in an internal email.
And this raises an immediate and really critical question about journalistic independence versus perceived political motivation.
Sure.
When a news organization undergoes such a high-profile ideological shift led by a figure like Weiss, managing the line between ensuring rigorous journalistic standards and being perceived as protecting the political interests of the new ownership's allies, well, it's extraordinarily difficult. The core issue is internal trust. Is the story being held because it's incomplete, or is it because it reflects poorly on the new administration or its associates?
A tough line to walk.
It is. And that tension is exactly what happens when these major corporate and editorial power shifts intersect.
So we've seen media consolidation driving these financial battles, and then the immediate editorial fallout that follows. This corporate uncertainty, it leads us right into the policy realm, where government intervention is just slamming the brakes on entire industries.
Yeah.
Let's start with the Trump administration's sweeping move against green energy.
This is one of the most aggressive executive actions of the administration so far. It signals a renewed commitment to dismantling these green energy projects.
The headline is just stunning. The Trump administration has halted the construction of all U.S. offshore wind construction projects.
Every single one.
The Interior Department paused federal leases for 5 major projects, stretching all the way from Massachusetts to Virginia. It's a massive intervention in a burgeoning industry.
And the rationale they provided was that the Department of War identified national security risks in recently completed classified reports. They're citing the rapid evolution of adversary technologies and, vulnerabilities created by these large-scale projects near East Coast population centers.
Which, of course, aligns perfectly with President Trump's longstanding, very visceral criticism of the industry. He's repeatedly called turbines big, ugly windmills. They ruin your neighborhood.
It's a perfect match.
And the immediate impact is easily quantifiable. These 5 projects, we're talking Vineyard Wind 1, Revolution Wind, Coastal Virginia, Offshore Wind, Sunrise Wind, and Empire Wind 1, they were expected to deliver nearly 6 gigawatts of electricity.
Enough to power all of Manhattan.
The entire city.
Yeah.
The market reacted instantly. Orsted shares fell more than 11%, and Dominion Energy, the lead developer in Virginia, fell 3.7%.
And we are seeing the political conflict that immediately follows something like this. Orsted was told to suspend all work on the Outer Continental Shelf for at least 90 days, and Democratic governors were quick to push back.
Right.
Connecticut's Ned Lamont, for one, criticized the administration for making stuff up regarding the national security justification, which allegedly centered on compromised ground-based radar.
Meanwhile, Dominion Energy tried to use the administration's own language against it. They called their Virginia project essential for American national security.
A very clever pivot.
They argue it's needed to provide reliable power to crucial assets like major warfighting installations, the world's largest warship manufacturer, and the largest concentration of data centers on the planet.
All tied to the leading edge of the AI revolution.
Exactly.
And that pivot is key. Everyone is framing their self-interest around national security to survive Washington's scrutiny. But the long-term implication for the industry is a chilling effect on green energy investment. This 90-day suspension with the threat of extension, it threatens the financial viability of billions and billions of dollars in projects.
And what about the jobs?
Well, progressive policy institutes have estimated that 12,000 direct and 5,000 indirect jobs were already tied to projects now endangered by these actions. I mean, why would any investor commit massive capital to U.S. green energy if regulatory approval is this fundamentally unstable?
That suggests that Washington is now using national security as the sort of universal justification for radical economic intervention. Where else are we seeing this strategy deployed right now?
The perfect parallel is in the tech sector, specifically the FCC banning foreign drones. This allows us to pivot into the broader context of the U.S.-China tech warfare.
That's a massive move. The Federal Communications Commission banned all drones and critical components made in a foreign country. And they're specifically targeting SZDJI technology and Autel Robotics. This action, driven by a White House group, flagged unacceptable risks, which means these companies cannot import, market, or sell new drone equipment in the U.S.
And the market impact is immediate, and frankly, it's potentially self-sabotaging for U.S. users. DJI accounts for between 70 and 90% of commercial, government, and hobbyist drones in the U.S.
70 to 90%.
That's the estimate. Commercial pilots are warning this spells the demise of their livelihoods, claiming there are simply no Western replacements. Eric Ebert, who monitors construction sites, he put it plainly. He's American-made through and through, but American drones can't compete.
Wow.
So this ban really highlights a critical national vulnerability. The U.S. consumer and commercial infrastructure is deeply dependent on Chinese tech that Washington now deems a security threat.
This regulatory barrier leads us into a deeper discussion of the China paradox, right?
Okay.
They're making these significant technological gains, yet their economy is just riddled with structural holes.
That paradox is the defining feature of modern China. On one hand, you have state direct investment that's closing the gap with the U.S. They have AI startups like DeepSeek challenging American dominance. They are racing to land astronauts on the moon by 2030, and they're installing advanced naval capabilities like their latest aircraft carrier with an electromagnetic launch system.
Bringing them closer to U.S. parity.
Exactly. And this is all driven by a strategy of self-sufficiency in critical sectors.
But the cost of this central planning, it seems astronomical. We have reports of massive misallocation of capital, leading to just legions of money-losing companies.
The data is shocking. Last year, there were 129 brands selling electric cars and plug-in hybrids in China. According to Alex Partners, only 15 of those are expected to be financially viable by 2030.
Only 15 out of 129.
Exactly. So hundreds of billions of dollars are being wasted on these vanity investments. And that misallocation is eating away at the budgets for critical social services and education.
Can you give us a concrete example of how that economic strain is hitting local communities?
Certainly. Look at Miachi County in Henan Province. Between 2022 and 2024, their spending on science and technology rose nearly 50%. It's a central priority. Yet, their overall government revenue fell more than 10%. They are developing an industrial park for robotics, but simultaneously, local teachers, sanitation workers, and college interns are going unpaid. This shows a very clear governmental priority. tech dominance and strategic industries above domestic quality of life and social stability.
So it sounds like the central government is prioritizing national pride and strategic exports over domestic consumption.
Precisely. The IMF managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, urged Beijing to shift the economy toward consumption. She famously said, "It's patriotic to spend money, given that many once bustling restaurants are now half empty."
But that's not what's happening.
Not at all. Xi Jinping appears to be doubling down on state support and exports. This is evidenced by the country's trade surplus topping $1 trillion in goods for the first time in the year through November. Despite slowing productivity and the fact that one out of six young people in Chinese cities is out of work, the strategy remains: export our way to strength.
And that aggressive centralized strategy in Beijing is, in a way, mirrored by the policy whirlwind coming out of the Trump administration, touching on military spending, corporate finance, and diplomatic relations. Let's start with this Golden Fleet vision.
The Golden Fleet is a classic example of prioritizing massive, visible displays of power, which are often criticized for not being optimized for the actual asymmetric threats posed by rivals like China.
President Trump announced the Navy will build a new Trump-class battleship. The first is to be named the USS Defiant, and this will be the flagship of this new fleet, alongside a new class of aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
These battleships will weigh 30 to 40,000 tons, larger than current destroyers, and will carry nuclear cruise missiles and potentially future weapons like railguns. Trump claims they will be 100 times more powerful than any battleship ever built.
And the critique from defense experts is incredibly pointed. Former Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery called the plan exactly what we don't need, citing the $5 billion cost per battleship. He argues these ships are focused on the president's preference for a cool-looking ship, a nod to historical battleships, rather than optimizing for modern warfighting needs. He notes, for instance, that the new frigate being planned will lack crucial elements like a vertical launch system or the Aegis ballistic defense system, making it fundamentally unoptimized for the Chinese threat in the Pacific.
And speaking of optimizing for national security, the administration is now picking a very public fight with defense contractors regarding their financial practices, specifically stock buybacks.
This is a deep dive into corporate governance and national security priorities. President Trump criticized contractors like Lockheed Martin and RTX for having executive pay upwards of $45 to $50 million a year, while simultaneously using company profits to repurchase stock instead of investing in new manufacturing plants to speed up production.
Citing delays in F-35 fighter jet delivery.
Specifically citing those delays.
So the core insight here is this strategic tension. Are contractors legally required to prioritize short-term shareholder returns like buybacks over long-term national security investment?
That's the crux of the conflict. While critics like Senator Elizabeth Warren argue buybacks hurt investment, defense analysts suggest a ban could negatively impact legacy firms by pushing investors toward venture-backed defense tech startups, which offer higher growth potential.
So it's not so simple.
Not at all. For legacy companies, buybacks and dividends are the traditional mechanism for attracting investors. Investment banking analysts are suggesting an outright ban is an overreach, and that clear contract signals from the government should incentivize the contractors to self-regulate their investments in production capacity. The whole sector is bracing for a potential executive order that could fundamentally reshape their financial structure.
Now, shifting to geopolitics. The administration is exerting power in the Western Hemisphere by isolating Venezuela economically.
Yes, the U.S. pressure campaign against Nicolas Maduro, including an FAA warning of a potentially hazardous situation due to a military buildup near Venezuela, has caused over a dozen international carriers to cease service.
Which effectively isolates one of the least connected countries on the planet.
Completely. And the humanitarian and economic consequences are severe for the Venezuelan people. We are talking about 40,000 people whose travel plans were affected in December alone. Beyond canceled holidays and lost deposits, this cuts off essential cargo, like pharmaceuticals and aircraft parts needed to maintain the small, aging commercial fleet that's still operating.
And what's the strategic goal here?
Well, Walter Russell Mead's analysis frames this as a smart strategic assertion of American hemispheric power. By intercepting oil tankers and imposing a partial blockade, the U.S. is reminding Beijing that critical Western Hemisphere imports needed by China would be hostages in any major confrontation. It's fundamentally about asserting dominance in our own backyard during a period of rising global tensions, even if it raises the risk of conflict with Caracas.
And another diplomatic flashpoint. The appointment of a special envoy for Greenland, which caused immediate anger from Denmark.
This move immediately created a diplomatic rift with a key NATO ally. President Trump appointed Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry as special envoy for Greenland, asserting that the autonomous island is essential to U.S. national security.
And Landry went even further, didn't he?
He did. He publicly stated it was an honor to take up the voluntary position to make Greenland a part of the U.S.
Wow. Denmark's reaction was immediate and fierce. They summoned the U.S. ambassador to demand an explanation. The Danish and Greenlandic prime ministers jointly reaffirmed sovereignty, noting that national borders are rooted in international law and that the U.S. shall not take over Greenland.
The appointment really confirms Denmark's longstanding concerns about Washington's true ambitions for the strategic Arctic territory. It's an aggressive assertion of geopolitical interests that completely bypassed normal diplomatic channels, causing a major disruption in an important alliance.
Okay, let's cover two critical domestic policy actions. First, the voluntary self-deportation stipend, which is being framed as a holiday campaign.
The Department of Homeland Security tripled the exit bonus for immigrants living illegally in the U.S. who leave voluntarily by the end of the year, raising the stipend to $3,000.
And the rationale?
DHS's rationale is financial efficiency. The $3,000 payment represents a significant saving over the average cost of a formal removal, which the government estimated this year to be $17,121.
Okay. And second, the legal fight over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. A coalition of Democratic state attorneys general are suing the administration over its efforts to essentially dismantle the agency, which has been mostly closed since February.
This is a fundamental challenge to the separation of powers. The Democrats argue that the CFPB's funding structure, drawing its money from the Federal Reserve System, not congressional appropriations, is critical.
Why is that structure so important?
That structure, mandated by Dodd-Frank, was designed specifically to insulate the agency from political defunding and partisan whims. The lawsuit claims the White House budget director, Russell Vought, is illegally refusing to request additional funds. This is a crucial legal challenge over the mandated existence and operational independence of a major consumer protection agency.
And finally, this astonishing and, frankly, unprecedented mass ambassador recall.
The administration abruptly recalled nearly 30 career ambassadors worldwide, giving them just until mid-January to vacate their posts. Officials claimed it was aimed at better aligning the State Department with the president's agenda.
But this kind of purge is...
It's without modern historic precedent. When you couple this action with the 80 top-level overseas posts that are already vacant, the U.S. has created significant immediate diplomatic gaps across every major theater, the Middle East, Asia, Africa, and Europe, at a time of rising global tension.
That is an astonishing wave of policy and regulatory intervention. Let's shift gears completely now and look at how these massive shifts from AI to geopolitics are hitting the U.S. worker right now. The U.S. labor market is ending 2025 on a very sour note, running headlong into this AI disruption.
The data points confirm a sharp structural deceleration in job creation and rising weaknesses that point towards some real trouble ahead.
The key data is unambiguous. The U.S. labor market hit a wall. The unemployment rate finished November at 4.6%, the highest since 2021. The number of unemployed Americans has increased sharply by more than 700,000 to 7.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
Total jobs added year-to-date are just under 500,000. It's a dramatic slowdown from the 1.6 million added in the first 11 months of 2024.
And we're not seeing full-scale mass layoffs yet, but it's more of a widespread stop in hiring and subtle trimming of headcount, particularly in the second half of the year. And while slowing wage growth is encouraging for the Federal Reserve's inflation fight, it offers very little comfort to workers who've been stretched thin by years of high inflation.
Let's break down the structural shifts and who was leading the job cutting, because one sector stands out as the singular engine of growth.
Well, ironically, the federal government is a leader in job cutting, with the Department of Government Efficiency moving to downsize the civil servant workforce to its smallest level in over a decade through targeted layoffs and voluntary departures.
And beyond government.
Beyond that, sectors sensitive to trade tariffs and economic swings like temporary help, manufacturing, and transportation, they've all trimmed headcount.
Oh.
And crucially, the tech sector continued to cut jobs while accelerating its investment in AI development.
So what's keeping the overall employment number from tipping into the negative?
There is only one bright spot driving virtually all job growth in 2025. Education and health services.
That's it.
The data clearly shows that without that single sector, which includes hospitals, clinics, and schools, the American labor market would have shed more than 100,000 jobs through November. This signals an incredibly thin and unstable foundation for overall economic growth.
And this instability is having a severe and disparate impact on specific demographic groups, which is often a key warning sign for the broader market.
This is the most concerning structural weakness. Unemployment for Black Americans jumped by more than 2 percentage points since the start of the year. That's a far faster rise than for other groups. This threatens to unravel the employment gains made post-pandemic, as Black workers are often concentrated in the low-skilled or entry-level jobs that are cut first when the economy weakens.
And what about young people?
Youth unemployment is spiking rapidly. The rate for teenagers, 16 to 19, shot up nearly 5 percentage points. And the rate for recent college graduates, 20 to 24-year-olds, also drifted higher.
This higher youth unemployment is known as scarring. What does that mean for their long-term professional lives, especially in the context of AI?
Scarring means these young workers miss out on critical skill-building opportunities and experience at the very start of their careers, which makes it extremely difficult to catch up later. And it directly links to the core problem. AI is eliminating the routine tasks that traditionally served as the bottom rung of the career ladder.
That structural reality is why we see this fundamental inversion of anxiety levels. Historically, young people were optimistic about new tech, but now 24% of workers under 35 express high concern about losing their job to AI.
Yeah, compared with only 10% of those over 55. AI is different from previous automation. When AI automates routine tasks, companies realize they need experienced employees who can combine AI's output with years of business knowledge and domain expertise, not entry-level staff just learning the basics.
So there's data to back this up.
There is. We are already seeing data showing rising unemployment for 22 to 25-year-olds in AI-affected sectors since 2022, while employment for older workers remains stable. The traditional career path is, well, it's fundamentally broken.
So if the bottom rung of the ladder is disappearing, what must companies do to develop the talent pool of tomorrow?
They have to recognize this as a structural shift and pivot to what we're calling AI-native tracks. So instead of assigning grunt work, junior employees must start with AI oversight and optimization roles, learning to train and monitor AI systems while building domain expertise.
Which requires a different kind of training.
A completely different kind. It requires mentor-intensive development programs to build judgment, strategy, and client management skills, which AI cannot replicate. The goal must be to prioritize demonstrated competency over mere tenure or time spent doing repetitive tasks.
And this connects back perfectly to the real-world implications of structural barriers, especially for highly skilled immigrants and refugees.
Absolutely. The problem of credentialing becomes even more critical. Alice Kang from Upwardly Global noted that while refugees are eventually an economic success story, many highly educated refugees like physicians end up driving for Uber for a decade because they just can't navigate bureaucratic licensing.
And if AI eliminates those simple entry-level jobs that might have provided temporary income,
then the pressure on professional credentialing pathways becomes immense for everyone. If the bottom rung disappears, we have to build better scaffolding to move people quickly into skilled AI-native roles.
From the macro job market, we move into the micro. How AI is entering the most intimate of spaces, the doctor's exam room. And the critical privacy and consent issues that arise. If 30% of practices are using AI scribes, this isn't a future issue. This is a you're-in-the-exam-room-now privacy issue.
This technology, AI scribes, that transcribe and summarize visits into notes, is being rapidly adopted because it cuts down on the crushing paperwork load for physicians. But it introduces profound new security and consent risks, especially since the audio is often stored in the cloud by third-party vendors.
We've distilled this down to 6 critical questions every patient must ask their providers immediately to protect their data. Let's start with the most basic. Consent.
Consent rules are a patchwork. They vary by state. Some states require explicit consent, others do not. As a patient, you must explicitly state your preferences. And while most providers seek consent as a matter of policy, technically, a practice may refuse to see you for a non-urgent visit if you opt out, given the enormous administrative burden they face.
Number 2, what is being recorded?
Assume everything is being recorded. Patients have to understand that anything said while the recorder is on may be reflected in the medical record, which can be seen by an insurer. If you are discussing sensitive topics, sexual health, mental health, substance use, you should interrupt the physician and ask them to pause the recording.
Third, who is processing my data and where is it stored?
The recording leaves the room and usually ends up with third-party vendors, whether they are giants like Microsoft or smaller medical technology startups, usually in the cloud. You must confirm that your healthcare provider has a HIPAA business associate agreement with that vendor.
And that agreement is key.
It is absolutely critical because it legally imposes requirements for permitted uses and safeguards of your data and makes the vendor directly liable for security under HIPAA.
Fourth, accuracy issues. How reliable are these digital notes?
While modern AI tools are good, error rates are around 1 to 3%. That small percentage can be catastrophic in medicine. AI can hallucinate details, it can omit relevant information, mix up speakers, and critically, it can show substantially poor accuracy when transcribing strong regional accents or Black patient speech.
It introduces undeniable and potentially dangerous bias into the patient record.
Exactly.
Fifth, will my information be used to train the AI product itself?
Under HIPAA, using your information for treatment or payment is generally fine. But if the data is used by the vendor or the clinic to develop a product, service, or other commercial application, separate patient consent is generally required. If you want your information quarantined from product development, you have to explicitly tell your provider to record that preference in your chart.
The entry of AI into healthcare is one of the most exciting and terrifying developments of the decade. Let's shift gears dramatically now, focusing on public health and corporate accountability, beginning with a monumental moment in pharmaceutical history, the FDA approval of the GLP-1 weight loss pill.
This marks the beginning of the inevitable shift in the obesity drug revolution. By moving from weekly injections to a daily pill, the market penetration will soar, transforming global public health outcomes and the pharmaceutical industry itself.
So the FDA approved Novo Nordisk's Wegovy pill, a tablet formulation of semaglutide. It's expected to launch in early January at $149 a month for the starting dose. Why is this pill formulation such a significant milestone right now?
It addresses two major barriers, patient compliance and potential cost. Pills appeal to the huge segment of the population that fears or avoids injections. And since pills are less expensive to manufacture than complex injection pens, they offer the prospect of lower prices and eventually better health insurance coverage. This is Novo Nordisk's second pill, but unlike Rybelsus, this new Wegovy pill is specifically approved for chronic weight management.
But the competition is right behind them. Eli Lilly plans to introduce its own GLP-1 pill, orforglipron, potentially within weeks or months. They're seeking expedited FDA review for approval in early 2026.
And the efficacy trials are critical for comparison. Novo Nordisk's pill helped patients lose an average of 16.6% of their body weight at 64 weeks.
Okay.
Lilly's highest dose showed 12.4% body weight loss at 72 weeks. And while both can cause gastrointestinal side effects, analysts project Lilly's pill will be a massive financial success. TD Cowen estimates orforglipron will generate $5.6 billion in sales by 2030, compared with $2 billion for the Wegovy pill.
And is there a key difference in how you take them?
There is, and it's an important differentiator. Novo Nordisk's pill requires patients to take it on an empty stomach and wait a half hour before eating, while Lilly's has no such restriction.
This approval is also critical for Novo Nordisk's corporate narrative, isn't it?
Oh, it's a chance for the company to regain momentum after a really difficult year where it lost the market lead to Eli Lilly. That failure led to the ouster of Novo Nordisk's chief executive and a board shakeup. They also lost a bidding war to Pfizer for the obesity drug startup Metsera.
So this is a big win.
This approval, which also includes a crucial secondary use, reducing the risk of heart attacks and strokes in people with established cardiovascular disease, is huge. Analysts estimate pills will eventually comprise about 25% of the projected $150 billion total obesity drug market.
Moving from pharmaceutical breakthroughs to a catastrophic failure in healthcare management. The crisis of overmedication among seniors. The numbers revealed by a Wall Street Journal analysis of Medicare data are shocking and demand immediate attention from you, the listener.
They are deeply alarming because they illustrate a systemic failure in coordination. One in six seniors, that's a total of 7.6 million people enrolled in Medicare's drug benefit, were simultaneously prescribed eight or more medications for at least 90 days in 2022.
And it gets worse.
It does. To zoom in, 3.9 million took 10 or more drugs, and over 419,000 took 15 or more.
This is where we need to introduce the Beers criteria, because it puts the danger into sharp relief. What is this standard?
The Beers criteria is essentially a highly specific do not use list of medications that geriatricians maintain. It lists drugs that should generally be avoided for older patients because they cause dangerous magnifying side effects.
And how many of these seniors were on those drugs?
Of those 7.6 million seniors taking 8 or more drugs, 3.6 million were prescribed at least one medication on the Beers list. This includes drugs like the highly sedating benzodiazepine, diazepam, the antihistamine hydroxyzine, and the muscle relaxant methocarbamol.
And the danger is magnified exponentially when these drugs are combined, right?
Absolutely. The Beers guidelines specifically warn against mixing multiple medications that affect the central nervous system, as this multiplies dangerous side effects, particularly falls. The analysis found that 147,000 seniors took all three categories of sedative drugs, benzodiazepines, muscle relaxants, and gabapentin, or similar drugs, at once.
Let's use the detailed case study of Barbara Schmidt, an 83-year-old great-grandmother in Delaware, to illustrate the human cost of this systemic failure.
Schmidt, despite considering herself healthy, was on more than a dozen different drugs prescribed by at least 5 different providers over the past year, including gabapentin, diazepam, and methocarbamol. As she added more sedating drugs, she began having repeated, terrifying falls, including one that shattered her hip and another where she fell down an escalator.
And her family was alarmed, but her care was fragmented.
Exactly. No single doctor took ownership of her medication history.
That is the core systemic failure, the lack of a consolidated history.
Yes. Pharmacists and geriatricians note that when patients see multiple specialists across different healthcare systems, the records don't always communicate. Even the Medication Therapy Management Review, or MTM, a consolidated review mandated by Medicare, often fails to apply to the most at-risk patients like Schmidt because she didn't qualify, likely due to a lack of enough chronic health conditions.
So what happened in the end?
In the end, it took her daughter intervening and securing a specialized geriatric review for her to stop taking the high-risk sedating drugs. She hasn't had a fall since, but her case shows that the system is failing the most vulnerable Americans.
That brings us to our final major public health issue: the link between contaminated cabin air, known as fume events, and severe neurological illnesses among pilots and flight crews.
This is a devastating and often hidden corporate accountability story. Doctors and neuroepidemiologists are increasingly convinced of a link between fume events, when engine oils or fluids leak into the air supply, and severe neurological diseases, including ALS, dementia, and acute depression.
We have several harrowing case studies detailing this potential link, which are hard to ignore.
The first is Ron Wyland, a pilot who developed ALS, a rapid neurodegenerative disease, months after a severe fume event on a Boeing 767 in 2016. He smelled engine oil and saw a fog deep enough that he struggled to see past the first 15 rows.
He died 3 years later.
Yes, and his lawsuit against Boeing settled in 2022 under an NDA. Wyland's neuroepidemiologist even testified that without the fume event, he would have likely developed ALS later in life, if at all.
Then there is the tragic case of James Anderberg, a Spirit Airlines pilot.
Anderberg suffered a fatal heart attack 50 days after a severe fume exposure in 2015. The event left him bedridden with vomiting, diarrhea, and confusion. Before his death, he showed erratic behavior and severe insomnia. His cause of death was ruled undetermined, but the medical examiner could not exclude the role of toxic exposure. His co-pilot wrote that if he hadn't immediately donned his oxygen mask, they would have killed every person on that aircraft.
And most tragically, pilot Andy Lasko, who died by suicide after a fume event on an American Airlines Airbus A330.
Lasko's family believes he was poisoned. He suffered muscle aches, headaches, and became a frightened, unsure, self-conscious human being. The industry stance Boeing denies the allegations, citing FAA approval and claims research is inconclusive, is based partly on the fact that companies actively object to placing air quality monitors on aircraft.
So they're essentially preventing the data needed to force accountability.
That's the argument. And that denial is contradicted by this shocking mortality study involving JetBlue pilots.
What did that study find?
It found that the suicide rate for JetBlue pilots between 2016 and 2019 was more than twice as high as the national average for the same age group. This suggests a profound, unaddressed psychological or neurological toll, further supported by medical professionals who see parallels between the symptoms of affected flight crews and soldiers suffering concussive trauma from chemical exposures on battlefields. The human cost here, suicide, ALS, dementia, is just staggering.
The struggle between government orthodoxy, corporate power, and individual rights continues as we shift into the justice systems. Let's start with a long-running, very familiar battle involving religious freedom and the Little Sisters of the Poor.
We're talking about the Catholic nuns who have been dragged through court for 12 years by states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey for failing to provide contraceptives to employees, despite having won twice already at the Supreme Court.
And the latest setback is a U.S. district judge in Philadelphia who tossed the Trump administration rule that granted the Little Sisters an exemption, calling the rule arbitrary and capricious.
The Beckett Fund, which represents the sisters, frames this as a clash between government orthodoxy and freedom of conscience. Beckett argues that the states cannot identify a single woman who would lose coverage if the sisters win, given that the states already widely give away free contraceptives.
So what's the implication?
The implication is that this ongoing litigation risks driving religious institutions, like the 20 nursing homes the Little Sisters run for the elderly poor, out of the public square. They're essentially saying the price of public service is violating their faith. The Supreme Court is expected to review this challenge again, especially since it seems designed to irritate the justices who already ruled on this twice.
Next, a huge legal victory for Elon Musk in Delaware that affects two-thirds of the Fortune 500 companies in America.
Delaware's Supreme Court unanimously reinstated Elon Musk's enormous 2018 compensation package, which is now worth about $139 billion. A lower chancery court judge had thrown it out, arguing shareholders were not fully informed and that the compensation violated the state's vague fairness standard.
So what's the significance of this reversal beyond Musk's wallet?
It reverses enormous uncertainty for the two-thirds of Fortune 500 companies incorporated in Delaware. The ruling is a loud and welcome signal to lower court judges to let shareholders decide what is fair. The initial ruling had created chaos regarding corporate law principles and encouraged plaintiff attorneys to seek huge fees. The original attorneys were awarded $345 million in Tesla stock or cash.
So this is about stabilizing the legal environment for corporations.
It is. This move is intended to stem the tide of companies that have been reincorporating in states like Texas due to the perceived capriciousness of Delaware's courts.
On the diplomatic and security front, we saw a significant setback for the Justice Department's efforts to prosecute alleged foreign influence.
A mistrial was declared in the high-profile case against Linda Sun, a former New York State aide accused of acting as a Chinese agent after jurors deadlocked on 19 charges. This really underscores the inherent difficulty in prosecuting alleged foreign influence under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or ARA.
For ARA being the specific legal tool for this.
It is. It's the specific legal mechanism the U.S. uses to track and prosecute political influence, and this result indicates the challenges of proving intent under the law. The Justice Department, however, does intend to retry the case.
Okay, let's quickly wrap up homeland and local crime.
A manhunt is underway in Georgia for three dangerous detainees who escaped from the DeKalb County Jail near Atlanta, including one convicted of murder. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has sued Washington, D.C. over its gun laws, challenging restrictions on certain semi-automatic weapons as infringing on Second Amendment rights.
Setting up a potentially seismic clash.
A huge one. And tragically, a small Mexican Navy plane carrying a child patient and seven others crashed near Galveston, Texas, resulting in at least five fatalities.
We've covered policy, justice, and the labor market. Now let's pivot to corporate and local economic snapshots, starting with what's poised to be the most profitable private equity deal of all time by dollar value.
This is a spectacular payoff on a highly contrarian bet. We're discussing Calpine, the natural gas power producer. It was acquired by Energy Capital Partners, or ECP, in 2017 for $5.6 billion at a time when cheap natural gas and soaring renewable energy production were squeezing margins.
Yeah.
ECP and its co-investors are now poised to have earned more than $25 billion when the sale to Constellation Energy closes next month. It just demonstrates the immense long-term payoff of savvy counter-cyclical investing.
Speaking of high-stakes corporate bids, we have the latest round of the uniform wars.
Cintas, the big maker of workplace products, is relentlessly pursuing UniFirst, the smaller uniform supplier, after nearly 4 years of failed attempts. They just submitted their fourth offer, $5.2 billion, or $2.75 per share. That's a premium of over 60%.
And what strategic signal is Cintas sending this time regarding regulatory confidence?
They are showing extreme confidence by including a $350 million reverse termination fee payable to UniFirst if the deal is blocked by regulators. That is a massive signal that Cintas believes it can navigate the antitrust environment. UniFirst's shares surged 16% on the news, reflecting investor impatience with the company's recent poor performance.
From high finance to high local anger, the property tax fight in Chicago. Homeowners are facing a $500 million property tax increase, even though the city portion remains unchanged.
This is a clear-cut case of tax burden shifting that fuels intense social inequity. New assessments shifted the burden dramatically from downtown commercial properties to individual homeowners. Major downtown landmarks, including Trump Tower, Hilton Chicago, and Hyatt Regency, successfully appealed for massive breaks, seeing drops of between 33 and 39% in their property values.
And what is the consequence for individual homeowners and vulnerable neighborhoods?
The Cook County Board of Review shifted the tax bill burden toward homeowners by 5 percentage points, or around $500 million, leading to an average increase of $700 per homeowner. The social implications are dire. The median residential tax bill in West Garfield Park, a long struggling neighborhood, jumped by a staggering 133%.
Driving people out.
Driving out Black families and reinforcing social inequity, making room for higher income people who can afford the elevated rents or taxes.
Finally, we can't overlook the sheer absurdity of Charlie Gavese's legal bills, which J.P. Morgan Chase is fighting to avoid paying.
The bank is calling the $74 million in legal bills patently excessive and egregious. Gavese was convicted of defrauding the bank after selling her startup, Frank, to J.P. Morgan, but a clause in the acquisition deal mandates the bank shoulder all associated legal costs.
And the details are something else.
The detailed list of expenses billed by her lawyers included things like cellulite butter and $530 worth of gummy bears. It really highlights the lengths legal teams will go to expense everything when dealing with a guaranteed funding source.
Gummy bears and cellulite butter, a perfect closing to the economics segment. Let's move to the culture, entertainment, and lifestyle deep dives, beginning with the persistent anxiety plaguing the theater industry.
The industry is stuck in a state of perpetual recovery. Domestic box office sales are stabilizing at about $8.8 billion this year, up 3% from 2024, but they are still falling short of the $10 billion analysts say is necessary for pre-pandemic profitability.
And the new fear is directly linked back to our opening story, the potential acquisition of Warner Bros. Discovery by Netflix or Paramount.
Theater owners are rightly fretting over this because historically, studio absorption leads to fewer movie releases and shorter exclusivity windows before films move to streaming. Even though Netflix and Paramount have made public promises, the fear remains very high among theater owners that their long-term supply pipeline will be chunked off.
So if they can't control the flow of movies, what's their response strategy?
They are upgrading the experience drastically. They're investing millions in plush lounge seating, massive screens, and enhancing food and beverage offerings like the in-house brewed Nebulous Hazy IPA and Bacon Brew House Burger offered by chains like Flix Boo House. Loyalty programs such as AMC Stubbs A-List are also critical to drawing people back and making the trip feel worthwhile.
Next, a surprising cultural development. Gen Z's love affair with Ralph Lauren. The preppy brand is suddenly cool again.
This is a fascinating convergence of strategy and cultural tailwinds. Gen Z, which was previously resistant, has embraced the brand's cozy, timeless aesthetic. This is fueling a massive hunt for vintage Ralph Lauren home decor. eBay searches were up 250% in November compared with 2024.
And this is part of a deliberate strategy.
It is. CEO Patrice Louvet has focused on winning over this new generation through collaborations like collections with historically Black colleges, while simultaneously reducing discounts and raising prices to maintain the aspirational nature of the brand.
And the serendipity factor.
The brand benefited enormously from the quiet luxury trend, nostalgia, and of course the massive unplanned Taylor Swift Travis Kelce endorsement, when she wore a striped Ralph Lauren dress that immediately sold out. Ralph Lauren is now the second most desirable brand to under 35 consumers, up from fifth in 2021.
From quiet luxury to extreme boozy beverages, let's talk about the new Sam Adams Utopia brand.
This is a product for prestige and bragging rights, not for mass market sales. Sam Adams co-concocted a new Utopia brand that is 30% ABV, a level so high it's illegal to sell in 15 states, and it retails for about $240 a bottle.
Compared to what for a normal Sam Adams?
A traditional Sam Adams is 5 to 6%.
What innovation allows for that extreme alcohol content and flavor?
It's brewed and aged in barrels that previously housed spirits and wines, giving it complex flavors of port, cognac, scotch, and rum. The process is volatile. One batch was so strong it caused the barrels to bulge and ate right through an insulated paper cup. The high-alcohol beer market is tiny, but it has a dedicated following, with bottles often reselling online for upwards of $1,000.
Let's transition to sports, specifically the immediate crisis of the new college football playoff, which delivered boring blowouts in its inaugural run.
The new 12-team playoff was supposed to deliver March Madness excitement, but instead we saw these dismal routs. Ole Miss 41-10 over Tulane, and Oregon 51-34 over James Madison. The results have immediately splintered the college football world into conflicting opinions on how to fix it.
Give us the most aggressive, elitist view on how to solve the blowout problem.
That's the former coach Nick Saban analogy. The group of five teams just shouldn't be included because they're not strong enough. Saban compared their admission to letting the winner of a AAA baseball league into the World Series playoffs, arguing that these smaller programs just lack the resources and scale to compete with the major conferences.
The historians offer a calmer counterpoint.
They do. They argue that blowouts are common in college football, regardless of the teams involved. They cite previous one-sided playoff games featuring blue bloods and argue that expecting March Madness upsets is unrealistic given football's physical nature, where the bigger, stronger team is almost always going to prevail.
What about the money view, which always seems to win in the end?
The consensus here is that the playoff will inevitably expand to 16 teams. This will solve nothing competitively, but it will create substantially more programming, advertising, and revenue. It's the philosophy that no content problem can't be solved by adding more content.
Finally, the cold logic view, trusting the algorithm over human bias.
This opinion suggests bringing back the computer rankings, like the Cigarin page, to ruthlessly screen out underdogs and limit the human emotion in selecting teams, essentially letting the robots take the heat for the gatekeeping decisions, ensuring only the most highly ranked, proven teams enter the field.
From college football angst to the NFL's final snap chaos, this past weekend saw three games decided on the final snap, all involving controversial officiating and rulebook conflicts.
The Detroit Lions loss was the most dramatic. Jared Goff's apparent game-winning touchdown was nullified by an offensive pass interference penalty on the final play. Coach Dan Campbell learned the hard way about Rule 4, Section 8, Article 2B, which states that if the offense commits a foul on a play that ends a half, there is no extension of the period.
Meaning the game just ends.
The game ended immediately on the penalty.
Conversely, the Seattle Seahawks benefited from a bizarre ruling that helped them win their game.
On the Seahawks' two-point conversion attempt, officials ruled that the quarterback's pass was a backward lateral, making the ball live. This allowed the running back to casually pick it up in the end zone after the whistle was blown, tying the game, which Seattle then won in overtime. The confusion over the rulebook led the opposing coach to publicly question the ruling.
And we also had a strange non-call involving receiver DK Metcalf.
Metcalf appeared to take a swing at a fan, but escaped punishment during the game because no flag was thrown. This highlights a quirk in the rulebook. If no flag is thrown on the field, the league office cannot intervene to advise the officials about what action to take, though the league will still have to decide in the coming days whether to fine or suspend Metcalf.
Let's finish with some final cultural and arts updates. We lost a significant figure this week.
We did. Betty Reed Soskin, the oldest National Park Service ranger, died at 104. She used her platform at the Rosie the Riveter WWII Homefront National Historical Park to discuss the often overlooked Black American experience during World War II, bringing a crucial historical perspective to American memory.
In the art world, the Museum of Fine Arts Boston is hosting a major survey of sculptor Martin Puryear.
The exhibition, Martin Puryear Nexus, features over 50 sculptures, highlighting his use of woodworking and his combination of African, minimalist, and modernist influences. Puryear served in the Peace Corps and trained in traditional West African carpentry. Works like Osso Oak and Bound Cone are often described as enigmatic objects teetering between art and craft, demonstrating meticulous construction while sometimes leaving the deeper meaning impenetrable for the viewer.
And we had a review of a book discussing the profound intellectual history underlying American liberty.
Jewish Roots of American Liberty is a fascinating collection of essays arguing that the Hebrew Bible and Jewish thought profoundly influenced American political culture and founding ideals. The book highlights the use of the Exodus story as a model for rebellion against Britain's pharaonic royalty, and how thinkers widely read in 18th century America, like John Milton, cited rabbinic sages to argue that individuals are not less than kings, laying the intellectual groundwork for the assertion of fundamental, inalienable rights.
As we synthesize the dizzying array of sources today, three overarching themes emerge with absolute clarity. What's the first one?
First, the powerful conflict between central state control and market forces. We see the Trump administration intervening heavily, right? Halting the offshore wind industry, citing national security, targeting defense contractor buybacks, dismantling the CFPB, whose Fed funding was designed specifically to prevent political interference, and asserting hemispheric power through the Venezuela airspace isolation.
And that clashes intensely with these massive market forces.
Exactly. Forces like the media M&A battle and the GLP-1 pill revolution, where corporate interests are driving structural change, often outpacing any kind of regulatory capture.
Okay. Theme number two.
The pervasive and deepening geopolitical tension. The U.S. drone ban and that aggressive Greenland envoy appointment are clear signals of an isolationist posture, asserting dominance in our hemisphere, even as China's state-directed strategy leads to incredible technological gains, AI, naval power, but also significant domestic economic holes, forcing difficult choices like prioritizing robotics parks over paying local teachers.
And third,
the fundamental disruption of technology on society's stepping stones and safety nets. AI is simultaneously promising incredible medical advances like the GLP-1 pill to reduce heart attacks, while structurally eliminating entry-level jobs for an entire generation. This technological shift, combined with the catastrophic failures of the social safety net we saw with the over-medication crisis among seniors, suggests that while the tech is advancing rapidly, the human systems required to manage it safely and equitably are catastrophically failing.
That structural failure is the key takeaway, especially regarding technology and control. We've seen AI entering the exam room, demanding immediate privacy and consent decisions from you, the patient. We've seen foreign drone technology banned over national security concerns. We've seen the career ladder removed for young workers. If AI demands judgment and strategy, not just technical fluency, and our social safety nets are failing at the most basic level, like preventing polypharmacy among the elderly, we have to question if our current educational and social scaffolding is simply unfit for the AI-driven world we've already built. Are we setting up an entire generation for career scarring that lasts decades?
The structural questions are far more complex than the daily headlines suggest. We have to find the answers before the next disruption hits.
We'll leave you with that thought for now. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
It was a pleasure dissecting the sources with you.
We'll see you next time.